Monitoring the content of massive pornography sites can be extremely difficult.
We always have the worst policy toward issues that are hard to talk about. Domestic violence or mental health or, frankly, anything to do with sex at all.
But after a damning expose by Nick Kristof of the New York Times, Pornhub responded by removing millions of videos from their site. I'm Tanzina Vega, and today in the Takeaway for Monday, December 21st, how Pornhub is trying to rectify the problem of illegal and offensive videos on its platform. Also on the show, how the killing of a prominent journalist in Mexico led to a coalition of news organizations working together to finish the work of murdered reporters. And to round out the show, the pandemic has altered so much of our lives, and that includes how we socialize.
You're lacking a lot of those skills that you thought you just took for granted.
So let's get started. I'm Tanzina Vega, and you're listening to The Takeaway, and it's great to have you with us. And just a brief warning that this story includes graphic depictions of sexual violence and pornography. And pornography is one of the things that a lot of Americans don't talk about, but millions of adults watch it, especially with the proliferation of websites like Pornhub. And now a new investigation by Nicholas Kristof of the New York Times has revealed that Pornhub and some of its competitors have also hosted videos that feature child pornography, so-called revenge porn, and even rape. Pornhub has since removed millions of unverified videos from their popular site, and in a statement, among other changes, Pornhub said they would only allow videos from verified users to be uploaded. But questions remain about why and how the videos were there in the first place. Today on The Takeaway, we're going to talk about some of the most disturbing and challenging issues facing the porn industry today. Nicholas Kristof joins us now. Nick, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Good to be with you.
In your piece, you wrote, and I want to make this, is, I think, is an important distinction, that the issue is not pornography itself, but rape. Tell us more about that.
You know, there's a debate about porn, and I didn't want to go there. I mean, whatever one thinks about porn, I think there is consensus that children should not be depicted and that rapes should not be depicted. And so what I really focus on is child sexual abuse imagery, which is out of control on the web, on porn platforms, but frankly also on social media, and then issues of rape videos. Tanzina, when I was first debating whether or not to do this article, I was prowling the website, and some of the first things I found were videos of unconscious women being raped, and the rapist was touching their eyeballs to show that they were completely unresponsive. And, you know, that is just disgusting. I mean, whatever one thinks about porn, surely we can agree that those kinds of videos should not be uploaded in ways that prolong an assault and victimize these women over and over and over.
I want to talk a little bit about what is clearly disturbing here and so many of the things that you've raised in your piece. The number of images and videos that are related to child sexual exploitation have gone up dramatically in the past several years. In 2015, there were about 6.5 million images. In 2019, there were 69 million images. Nick, what does this say about us? And what does this say about the industry?
So I think a couple of things. One you alluded to that, you know, this is a hard subject to talk about. And one of the things that I think in journalism we note is that we always have the worst policy toward issues that are hard to confront, hard to talk about, you know, whether it's domestic violence or mental health or, frankly, anything to do with sex at all. And so I think that's part of the issue that because these are hard conversations to have and it's an icky subject, so we've tended to avoid regulating it the way we should. And the other is that there has been complete impunity on the part of the platforms. And so I think from the point of view of executives at any one platform, if they get, you know, as long as there are some people who want to see these images and as long as they can monetize them by putting advertising against them, then they're going to keep doing that as long as there are no consequences. And so a solution is going to have to involve you know, not sensitivity training, but consequences.
We're going to talk a little bit about what Pornhub's response has been in just a moment. In your piece, Nick, you also talk about the role that these videos have also played in child trafficking. There's a woman you interviewed named Callie who says, quote, Pornhub became my trafficker. Tell us about her and other people like Callie.
So, yeah, there's this pattern of obviously young women are trafficked in the U.S. and in other countries. These days, everybody who rapes them has a cell phone, and invariably they then video record some of those assaults and then post them on Pornhub or Xvideos. And so what these young women say is that, you know, then their humiliation is extended indefinitely because they can never escape that past. These videos are there forever. And it's amplified because Pornhub in the past allowed downloads of these videos, so that even if the police later insisted upon the removal of some of these videos, then meanwhile, thousands and thousands of people had downloaded them and then were sharing them with each other and then re-uploading them to other sites. And so, I mean, one of the things that is helpful is that Pornhub has now stopped downloads. It's not perfect. There are still ways to download, but it's helpful.
So to that point, Pornhub released a statement after your piece outlining some of the steps they're going to take, they say, to prevent this from happening. And they talked about only allowing properly identified users to be able to upload content, banning downloads, as you mentioned, and making, quote, key expansions to our moderation process. Nick, based on your reading of their statement, do you think that's enough?
So an awful lot depends on how these are implemented. And, you know, for example, an authorized user has become authorized in the past by simply putting their name on a piece of paper and showing it next to their face. And, you know, no real ID has been demanded. But that's certainly a step forward. The absence of downloads is real progress. And, you know, moderation, Pornhub has improved moderation over the last year, but they've tended to focus on American girls and young women because they're more likely to be litigious. And so there has been much less interest in actually, you know, cracking down on videos of Chinese women being raped or Indonesian women being raped. Or I talked to a Colombian woman who had videos on the site. And so I think, you know, I think that the issues that they talked about are really important. It's tremendous that they took down these videos that were not from verified users. But let's see how they actually implement it. And I've got to say, Tanzina, it's also, you know, we can't just go after one platform. That's unfair to it, and it's not terribly effective. There, in particular, there's a European-based company that owns Xvideos and xnxx.com, and you know, I hope that there will also be pressure on that company.
And one of the things, Nick, that worries me here is that with the increased proliferation of these videos, as we mentioned a couple of minutes ago, just almost tenfold across the web, I'm wondering whether or not this reflects how we are seeing the vulnerable, how we see women, how we see power in this. Like, why? I'm trying to get at why these videos have become so popular and why they're just proliferating all over the world.
Boy, that's a grim sociological question. I do think it has a lot to do with impunity, and that once companies find that they have a business model that can show, 17-year-olds being raped, then they go on and find similar impunity with 15-year-olds and so on. On Xvideos, I tried searching middle school, and it returned thousands of videos. And one of its suggested searches was elementary school. And that just you know, boy, that just floored me. I think it's an escalation in exactly the wrong direction.
Nick, what has the government done, if anything, about this? I mean, we're talking about criminality, aren't we? Shouldn't the Department of Justice or local police departments or somebody be involved in this?
Yeah, so I sure think so. I think historically governments haven't gotten involved either in the U.S. or in other countries, again, because it's just an icky topic. And I think that is now changing, both on the criminal side and on the civil side. There, Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which has provided a certain amount of immunity on the civil side to these platforms, has been amended, and there's talk about further amendments, which should make it easier to allow civil suits that create some incentive for these companies to police themselves. So, for example, there's a suit now underway by women who had been secretly filmed in a changing room at a college, showering, and that video was placed on Pornhub. They're now suing the company, and if they win, you know, Pornhub is going to be a lot more careful about those kinds of images. As for the criminal side, there is legislation that is now introduced in the U.S. and also seems to be on its way in Canada, where Pornhub is based, that would tighten regulation of these companies and presumably, you know, lead to some potential criminal liability.
And finally, Nick, the question here is how much these efforts will actually send a chill down the spine of the pornography, not just the industry, but those players who are putting up these types of videos, or whether these videos will go even further underground. What are your thoughts on the future of this here?
So, look, I don't think that porn is going to be eliminated, including the, you know, really outrageous videos. And so I'm sure some will go underground and some will go to the dark web. And it's going to be, you know, there is going to be a tendency for videos to migrate from platforms in countries like the U.S. or Canada, where there's more of a push to regulate, to Ukraine, to Belarus, etc. But I think that there are still ways to crack down, to regulate, to limit. We're not going to be eliminated, but to reduce the number of 14-year-olds who have their lives shattered because they have naked videos of themselves or rape videos of themselves that are placed on these sites and broadcast to the world in ways that humiliate them. And in many cases, as you know, I wrote, drive them to attempt suicide. You know, we can do better. We're not going to be perfect, but can we do better? Absolutely.
Well, let's see that if that actually manifests. Nick Kristof, thank you so much for your reporting. Nick Kristof is a columnist for the New York Times and the author of the recent investigation, The Children of Pornhub.
Thank you, Tanzina.
You can read the full Pornhub statement on our website at thetakeaway.org. And if you need help with issues of sexual abuse, the National Sexual Assault Hotline is 1-800-656-4673. And if you're having thoughts of suicide, call the National Suicide Prevention Hotline at 1-800-273-8255 to get help. We also wanted to get some thoughts on this topic from Cindy Gallup, who's the founder and CEO of Make Love Not Porn, which is a site that tries to make more conscious sex scenes available from verified users.
The problem is we all watch porn, we don't talk about it. Porn therefore exists in this parallel universe, in this shadowy other world. When you force an entire industry into the shadows and underground, you make it a lot easier for bad things to happen, and you make it very difficult for good things to happen.
Cindy's been on the show a couple times talking about sex work and how to make the industry better.
I think it's very important when people look at what is happening with Pornhub to differentiate between sex work and sex trafficking and appalling trade in rape videos. Those are two separate areas. And it's very important that legitimate, and by the way, legal, adult sex workers and adult entertainers do not find their livelihood at risk because of the absolutely appropriate moves to root out the appalling bad actors.
So part of the problem, Cindy says, is that Americans aren't good when it comes to talking about sex.
Our parents bring us up to have good manners, work ethic, sense of responsibility, accountability. Nobody ever brings us up to behave well in bed. But they should, because in bed, values like empathy, sensitivity, generosity, kindness, honesty, respect are as important as those values are in every other area of our lives where we're actively taught to exercise them. The only way that you end rape culture is by doing what I and Make Love Not Porn are attempting to do, which is embed in society an openly talked about, discussed, promoted, and very importantly, aspired to gold standard of what constitutes good sexual values and good sexual behavior. At Make Love Not Porn, we are socializing and normalizing good sexual values and behavior to get to a societal scenario where celebrating rape situations and enjoying posting rape videos on Pornhub is absolutely no longer behavior that anybody will condone. It is tremendously important to tackle this in the real world, not simply by censoring and blocking what turns up on Pornhub and on Facebook and many other platforms. And so first and foremost, the issue isn't porn, the issue is that we don't talk about sex in the real world. We have to do that openly and honestly. We have to encourage social standards of good sexual values and behavior to get everybody to understand how we should all be operating around sex.
Cindy Gallup is the founder and CEO of Make Love Not Porn. Last week, we heard from the Committee to Protect Journalists about the growing threats to press freedom around the world. According to the International Federation of Journalists, for the fourth time in 5 years, Mexico has had the most number of journalists killed. In 2020, at least 14 journalists had been killed while doing their work. And the Committee to Protect Journalists found that at least 9 of those were killed directly as a result of their work. So this year, an international coalition of news organizations began taking up the unfinished work of many of these journalists in an initiative called the Cartel Project. Among the many critical stories being unearthed, the project has now reported on how the journalist Regina Martinez was killed for her work on the links between organized crime and the Mexican government. Here with me now is Nina Lacani, environmental justice reporter for The Guardian. And Nina has worked in Latin America as an investigative reporter for years. Nina, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
Nina, let's start off with the killing of Regina Martinez. What was she investigating before her death?
So Regina Martinez was an investigative reporter in the state of Veracruz, which is the most dangerous state in Mexico to be a journalist. And she had been investigating, you know, in various different aspects, the nexus between organized crime groups, mainly drug trafficking groups, and local powerful politicians. And one of the big investigations that she was almost close to finishing was about the, you know, huge rise in forced disappearances, people who had just simply vanished in the state as organized crime had taken a greater hold. And she had found that a really exponential rise in bodies being thrown into paupers' graves in public cemeteries, and people who, you know, who had been killed with signs, you know, what seemed to be signs of just executions with single or, you know, gunshot wounds. And that that discovery would have exposed these links between organized crime and the state, because you can't disappear people, huge numbers of people, without there being, complicity with state authorities, with police, with prosecutors, with politicians. And that was going to be, that would have been a really explosive investigation had she been able to publish that. And she was also investigating, missing millions, a huge rise in public debt, public contracts being awarded to, the cronies and friends of senior officials. So she was, she was investigating a number of things that she had for many years, but they were two of the sort of key investigations that she was working on when she was murdered in 2012.
Did Regina's death mark the beginning of, or at least a change in the increased wave of violence in Mexico against journalists?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, journalists had been killed in Mexico before, but she was the most prominent journalist to be killed. She was a national reporter for a really prominent investigative news weekly called Proceso. And really what we saw after her murder was just a really significant increase in journalists being killed, mainly regional and local, but also some national journalists. Across the country, with the state of Veracruz, where she was from and where she worked, becoming the most dangerous place on the planet to be a journalist. So it really did. And I think it just showed us, as journalists, as our Mexican colleagues for sure, is that if they can kill someone as well-known and prominent as Regina and get away with it, all of us are vulnerable. And that's exactly how it played out.
Why is it so dangerous to report on organized crime in Mexico? Is it because of what you mentioned, the government being complicit in these killings, or is it cartels that are just sort of out of control? Like, what is it that makes Mexico one of the worst, if not the worst place for journalists right now?
What we know for sure is that the journalists most likely to be targeted are those investigating the links between organized crime and state officials. It isn't those who are just investigating organized crime per se. It is specifically those who are investigating the role played by state forces, security forces, politicians, mayors, the army, the navy. It is those specifically those who are targeted. And why do they continue to be killed? Because there is almost impunity is almost guaranteed. The Committee to Protect Journalists say that around 90% of crimes against journalists go unsolved. I would say it's even greater than that. If you look at how many people who masterminded those crimes, who ordered, who paid for, who benefited from the silencing journalists, almost none have ever been brought to justice, right? So that, it's a combination of getting at these sort of links between state structures, state complicity, individuals in power, and the lack of justice. Again, impunity means that there is state complicity, right? Because these crimes are not properly investigated, they're not prosecuted. And in the case of Regina Martinez, one man was jailed, but we're absolutely sure he had nothing to do with it. He was a scapegoat, while those who ordered and benefited from her crime have never faced justice.
You've also reported on the question of weapons entering Mexico, which are used by organized crime, members of organized crime. Where are those weapons coming from?
Well, I mean, I think, the primary source is still the U.S., coming over the border in the southern border of the U.S. into Mexico. But as part of the cartel project, we really dug deeply into the sale, the legal sale of arms from Europe and from Israel into Mexico and where these weapons end up. So one thing that we can say is that the vast majority of journalists who have been killed in Mexico in the last 15 or 20 years have been killed with a weapon from a foreign country, right? And our investigation really got into sort of this exponential rise in arms sales, in weapon sales, to the Mexican military, who sort of controls the sort of arms trade, really, and how these guns and these weapons are then sold on to local police forces, and how that they often do end up in the hands of organized crime groups.
In 2021, Nina, what is the expectation for journalists in Mexico right now? I mean, is it going to change? Is President Andrés Manuel López Obrador going to take any action, given that this project has now taken off and is really exposing the precarity of being a journalist in Mexico?
Well, the current president, like his predecessors, have known for a long time that being a journalist is dangerous business in Mexico. You know, they can't say that they haven't known and they don't know, because it's unfolded in front of their eyes. You know, it's almost a journalist a month or more that's killed in Mexico. I mean, it's just a huge, you know, the impact on democracy and on citizens and truth telling and information has been so significant for so many years. We have, you know, while the current president, López Obrador, said that he would look into see whether the case of Regina Martinez, for example, could be reopened, that is just not good enough. You know, there is, you know, we have seen no significant statements or steps or actions, most importantly, to suggest that this widespread systematic impunity for those who perpetrate violence and attacks against journalists is going to be tackled. We just haven't seen any evidence that that's going to change.
Nina Lacani is the environmental justice reporter for The Guardian, who's reported from Latin America for years. Nina, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. The American dream, the ability to come to a foreign country with nothing in your pocket and build a successful life with liberty and justice for all. Well, maybe not for all. Since the founding of the United States, stereotypes about minority groups and which ones were more likely to succeed have led to the flawed notion of the model minority. Arun Venugopal is a senior reporter with WNYC's Race and Justice Unit, and he recently wrote about the fallacy of the model minority and the effect those stereotypes have had for The Atlantic. Arun, thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Tanzina.
When we say model minority, what do we mean?
Model minority is a term that emerged in the 1960s. It was a New York Times Magazine article by William Peterson, an academic, who said he'd observed this phenomenon among certain people, specifically Japanese Americans, who, despite having been interned and who having faced lots of discrimination, seemed to be doing quite well. And there was another term that he used, I think it was in quotes in the article, but referring to problem minorities. Coming as it did at that time, it really set up this this juxtaposition between so-called better minorities, the ones who seem to roll with the punches, who seem to succeed, who seem to speak up for the meritocracy, this idea of it, versus the ones who just couldn't. Think about the backdrop, riots, social unrest happening in Black communities in America. It really created this dichotomy between certain groups and others.
And how has the usage of this term, I'm sure many of us have heard this term, really affect the perception of how different groups of people of color are treated in this country? I mean, there are certain groups who fit this model minority stereotype, at least in, you know, in the popular culture sense. And those groups, you would suggest, are treated better than others?
Definitely. I mean, we're talking about access to certain networks, to certain spaces. Who are the people who are allowed to move into better neighborhoods with better access to schools, who are treated relatively speaking, on par with, say, white liberals who move into these neighborhoods? We have sort of created these myths about why certain groups can assimilate, if you will, and why others can't, without really taking a hard look at how the U.S., the government, policies, how the culture itself allowed for this to happen. And my article in The Atlantic really sort of explores how that started happening in the 1940s during World War II, and then really ramped up in the post-war era, specifically because of the Cold War. It was really a PR move used by the U.S. to sort of broadcast to the world that we were this benevolent, harmonious country, that, you know, we didn't really have racial divisions. Look at these Asian Americans who are flourishing. Nothing to see here.
Was it meant, Arun, also to obfuscate some of the social wrongs that had been perpetrated on other communities of color in this country, like slavery and the genocide of indigenous people? Was this sort of to obfuscate that reality?
Definitely. You know, coming as it did in the post-war era, this emerging sort of idea really was meant to sort of divert attention away from all of the problems over segregation, over the bad treatment of Black Americans, over the genocide of Native Americans. It was used as a way to sort of distract, you know, the world's attention away from serious structural inequities.
Arun, you grew up in a middle-class suburb in Texas with immigrant parents from India. And some would say that that was a, quote, model minority family. What was your story? How did your parents come to the United States?
Well, Tanzina, they moved here 50 years ago to this country and eventually settled down in Houston. And first we moved to this, my parents moved to this middle-class neighborhood. And then I remember when I was about five or so, we moved to a much fancier neighborhood. It was a beautiful area, forested, these huge lots, big houses, and I was very lucky. My sisters are also very lucky. And, you know, very much synonymous with the American dream and that whole idea. We didn't really think at the time, and I didn't really, to be honest, reflect until I was much older, the fact that we did not have, as neighbors, we did not have, say, Black neighbors or Latin American neighbors. There were no Latinos living on our street, very few Black residents in the whole area. They were excluded, while today there are a lot of Asian Americans in that neighborhood. It's a very exclusive neighborhood. Didn't realize at the time that we were, I guess, allowed in, if you will, that we were facilitated our entry, whereas for certain people, they were very much kept out.
Was that something that you came to realize, or had your parents sort of imparted that to you, where they said, you know, they might have given you some, you know, reasons why, you know, people may say certain things, or was it just sort of, as you said, you were easily able to become part of the fabric of the community?
I think that we had sort of our blinders on, if you will. It's not that we were, you know, repeatedly told that, you know, in explicit terms that we were better and that those people were not, and that's why they're over there. But I think it happens at a much subtler level, why certain neighborhoods are, I guess, you know, not the neighborhoods where we would live in. And this is a phenomenon that I, you know, I write about, which has been documented by scholars that, you know, Indian and Pakistani middle-class families, they took part in a phenomenon known as brown flight, according to this one academic, Uzma Qureshi. We left, just like white flight, brown flight, it was a similar phenomenon where we left neighborhoods which might be more diverse, might have more Black residents, ostensibly so we could be near other people who were like us, but also for all those euphemisms, like good schools. And it constituted a similar process of sort of propagating racial segregation in Houston, and I'm sure many other parts of the country. And it raises these questions of who are we in the larger sort of racial landscape? We are minorities, we're immigrants, but in some ways we have aligned with systems of, you know, inequality, you know, racial segregation, other, you know, really insidious processes. And I think, you know, we need to sort of have a more serious conversation about what needs to be done now, you know, to address these historic wrongs.
Are those conversations happening in the communities that you're referring to, Arun?
I think that, you know, I've been surprised to see the way in which this piece is really kind of taken off. A lot of people are saying, like, it's like making the rounds on WhatsApp and social media amongst aunties and uncles. I have people who are older who seem to be taking this problem seriously in a way that has been a pleasant surprise. And I think that the events of recent months, between the protests, between the obvious, you know, issues, criminal justice, Black Lives Matter, the pandemic, have really sort of shown a light on the flaws of this country in a way that many immigrants that they came here 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago didn't necessarily appreciate. You know, America looked like really like kind of that, you know, sort of shining house up on the hill. And I think in some ways they wanted it to be that way because it affirmed their narrative of doing well here, that, you know, if you just put in the work, you'll do fine. And I think the Trump era, and specifically the pandemic and the protests, have made them realize it's not quite so simple as that. And we have to take a harder look and figure out what our role is as so-called model minorities, or to jettison that term and you know, understand how we've been aligning, I guess, with very insidious forces.
There's also, I mean, the model minority myth is expecting a lot of complacency from groups and individuals, isn't it? It's expecting to, like you said earlier, go along, get along sort of approach, and everything is fine. And if I just, you know, and it expects a certain amount of, I think, meekness in it, mm-hmm. and complacency. And I wonder if those things are harmful in and of themselves to the people who are labeled with that model minority label.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's a great, it's the easiest thing in the world to say, like, you know, I'm good, I'm fine. Mm-hmm. We don't need to do anything about this. And, you know, what you're doing is, you know, whatever term you want to use, virtue signaling or whatever. I think indifference is just, you know, as good as being, you know, very explicitly racist, right? Like, you know, and people like Ibram Kendi, you know, scholars who have said you have to be anti-racist, you know, and how do you do that? And these are very complicated conversations, you know, and I think getting into the very thorny issues of identity, you know, people especially who come from colonized societies, post-colonial societies, and getting rid of all that baggage, even as they're trying to sort of address their own privilege, if you will, over here.
It also creates a monolith out of a community that doesn't allow for individual expressions, does it?
That's true. I mean, I think that that's something that we've, you know, being painted with a broad brush in the broader discourse, having these myths thrown on us that there's something inherent about, you know, all these people who come from over there. They have family values, and they're just better parents. I mean, basically, these are things that are propagated even now, Tanzina. And it is really kind of, I guess, counterproductive, because it doesn't necessarily shed light on the people within the community who haven't necessarily had the same access to resources, to privilege, to networks, to good neighborhoods and good schools. And I think that this is a time where, when you do have rising political power, you have a vice president elect who is herself of Indian, partial of Indian extract, it allows you to see that maybe we do have certain access that we need to take seriously and take responsibly and see within the community how it hasn't played out always in the same ways.
Arun Venugopal is a senior reporter with WNYC's Race and Justice Unit, and his article called The Making of a Model Minority is featured in this month's issue of The Atlantic. Thanks so much, Arun.
Thanks, Tanzina.
Back with you on The Takeaway, I'm Tanzina Vega. The COVID-19 pandemic has altered so much of our lives, including how we socialize and interact with others. And despite being social creatures, many of us have been forced to spend much of the past 10 months physically distancing in order to protect ourselves and the people around us. And when we do connect with people, whether it be virtually on Zoom or in person at a distance, things can feel different, maybe even a bit awkward. Here's what you had to say.
Hey, this is Zach from Providence, Rhode Island. And yes, I feel tremendously awkward and feel like I need to regenerate a lot of my social skills during this time. I think isolation, quarantining, and general separation from your social groups has made it so that you're lacking a lot of those skills that you thought you just took for granted.
As an introvert on the spectrum, I have noticed that I'm not as comfortable being around people as I was prior to the pandemic. I feel more awkward in both in-person and virtual meetings. I feel that things that I learned in the past are slowly slipping away from me.
Tai Tashiro is with us. Tai is a psychologist and the author of Awkward, The Science of Why We're Socially Awkward and Why That's Awesome. Tai, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So are we all a little bit awkward right now?
We sure are. It's definitely a different kind of time. And even those of us who aren't used to feeling socially awkward, I think can feel pretty awkward these days.
So what's changed? I mean, obviously, what's changed? You know, we're all Zooming and we're all, you know, staying 6 feet away, or most of us are at least. What's changed about our social skills?
Well, I think, you know, part of the reason folks are feeling like their social skills are a little rusty or they're feeling more socially awkward is, you know, largely attributable to the social expectations changing or being altered. So like take physical distance, for example. In the United States, it's usually about 18 inches of personal space we give each other. Now it's about 72 if we're following the guidelines. And so that just feels awkward, or it feels like we're not doing the right thing, partly because it's going against an expectation we followed for our entire lives. Even handshakes or hugs or the ways we usually greet one another, those have changed as well. And then there's the Zoom calls and the whole set of social skills that go along with doing well in those kinds of environments.
Ty, aren't there people, though, who are sitting here saying, my gosh, I can't wait until this thing is over so I can just run through the streets and hug everyone and kiss everyone and connect with people? So are there those who are feeling this more so than others?
Yeah, well, I can tell you I'm an introvert and I feel that way. I can't wait till all of us can do that. And there is a stronger social drive in some people. Extroverts notoriously like a greater variety of social interaction and more social interaction. But even for the people who are squarely introverts, there is that urge right now to connect with people. And it's been a long time. And by the time we get to the other end of this, it'll have been over a year, which is an extraordinarily long time for human beings to endure that kind of social distance.
So we are wired to want to be around other people, even if some of us take that wanting in doses, right? That some people may just want to be around people for shorter amounts of time, but there still is a biological imperative here to want to be social.
That's right. So one of the hot areas in psychology over the past two decades or so has been what they call the fundamental need to belong. And it's been this realization that this need to be social and feel like we belong to a social group is just as necessary and fundamental as things like hunger or thirst or more biological things we typically thought of being in a different kind of category. But yeah, the need to belong and to be accepted, it's one of the most core human motivations that we have.
Are there ways that we should be working to keep our social skills sharp? And I guess I'm thinking about an experience where, you know, I'm a mom and my child and I have not had a lot of chances to interact with other parents. And going to the pediatrician's office in the waiting room is sometimes just the ability to see other babies and see other parents can help. Are there ways that we can stay sharp and as we sort of wait eagerly for this pandemic to pass?
Yeah, I think there's kind of two sides to that, and that is a good point that you can get a little bit worried. Like, am I going to lose my social skills, or will my social skills be worse when we come out of this? And the short answer to that is we're all going to be okay, which is really good news, I think. So
thank goodness.
I know. I get nervous, too. I even know the data, and I think, am I getting worse at these things? And we're a little out of practice, maybe. But social skills actually kind of look like language development. We really intuitively pick up on how to interact with other people. And this big brain of ours, a lot of it's devoted actually to decoding other people's social cues, figuring out how to interact in the best ways possible, how to empathize with someone's situation. So these things are really burnt into our brain really well, and we'll be just on the other side.
I'm also wondering, Ty, there was an interesting piece recently that showed that there are people who are dating who are meeting on Zoom and everything's fine, and then they meet in person and they go, ooh, there's no chemistry there. Is that part of what we're seeing too?
Yeah, that's been a curious kind of thing. some of the research I did previously was about romantic relationships and partner choice. And one of the things I privately thought when this pandemic started is maybe this will be good for dating because it'll make people cycle less frequently through different dates. It'll slow people down, which is kind of exactly what we needed. And one of the things I've been wondering about when people say, well, now I met the person and it wasn't as good, is maybe people's criteria or threshold for what they think is acceptable has actually gotten higher because there's only so many people that you can go out on dates with and still be safe about the pandemic.
interesting. So you're optimistic, though, about us being able to come through this and still be able to get together and socialize and have parties. I mean, I would imagine we are still seeing lots of people doing that anyway. So there still feels like there's a drive to do that. Despite health warnings, people are still gathering.
Yeah. There's certainly a line you can cross there. If you have your social bubble, I think that's seems to be the better way to do it. But one of the silver linings, I think, is that a lot of people are saying their relationships are becoming more meaningful. They're becoming deeper, and they're more grateful for the time that they do have with the people that they want to get close to.
And who can ask for more than that, especially around this time of year? Tai Toshiro is a psychologist and the author of Awkward, The Science of Why We're Socially Awkward and Why That's Awesome. Tai, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Hi, I'm Greg Keenan, restaurant operator from Conshohocken, PA. And I've come to realize how much eyes communicate. And that's all we've got with the mask on. So here's to seeing lots of smiling eyes until the masks come off.
Hey, this is Edwin in Dallas. I feel so awkward going to stores. I'm like, what do I do with my feet? Am I walking too fast? What am I doing with my knees? And I don't want to touch anything. It's been rough.
And that's all for today, folks. Thanks so much for tuning in. If you missed anything or you want to listen back again, you can check out our podcast, and you can find that wherever you get your podcasts or at thetakeaway.org. And don't forget, send us a voice memo with your thoughts on any topic, record it into your phone, and email it to takeawaycallers@gmail.com. You can also send us a tweet. We're at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and we'll see you tomorrow.